The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And we are live. It is Pollock and Thurston coming at you on this Wednesday, March the 6th, already into the third month of Q1, as we would describe. How are you, Brandon?
Yes. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. We have plenty to get to on today's show, a guestless edition of Pollock and Thurston, but we have plenty to dig into, from 10K filings to the results of NCIS investigations. Who knows where things will take us? And when we don't have guests, that means we will lean as well on you, the listeners. If you want to throw in a super chat, throw in a question, take us off course, you're more than welcome to do so. But we will be monitoring the chat as much as we can. Behave yourselves. But we are going to be focusing at the beginning of the show on the results that came out last Friday night. We knew of the NCIS investigation that went into the claims made by Ashley Massaro. This was revealed by Tim Marchman, formerly of Vice, official to be determined. And he noted in his reporting that there was an investigation that closed in 2020. The contents of the findings of the investigation, though, were not available before a Freedom of Information Act request. And the turnaround was relatively quickly because this was a known investigation. It had been completed 4 years ago, and we got the results on Friday night. Both Brandon and I have had a chance to go through the 84-page investigation, and this was some interesting insight of who was spoken to and what details came out and what you can ascertain from them.
Yeah, it's kind of written in reverse chronological order. You have entries of the investigation that are sort of installed in several pages as we go backwards into the document, which is, as you mentioned, about 80 pages. What we have here is the investigation records from the Navy's investigation organization. And I should mention at the top here, they do have a job working for the federal government. So anything I say here or anywhere else is not the views of any government entity and are only my own personally. But we do have a description of a lot of different interviews that investigators did related to this case, which was only done, of course, in 2019 after Ashley Massaro passed away and after her affidavit explaining these allegations was made public.
That's right. And just the kind of condensed version of the story is that there was a WWE tour of Kuwait and several other countries in July of 2006 that Ashley Massaro was part of. Others that were on the tour included Maria Kanellis, Ron Simmons, Jimmy Hart, and a PR representative at the time with WWE, Gary Davis, among them. And it was revealed days after Ashley Massaro took her life in May of 2019 through lawyer Constantine Kairos that Ashley Massaro had provided an affidavit as part of their suit against WWE, outlining an alleged sexual assault that happened while she was in Kuwait and being treated for dehydration. And she outlined in the affidavit being sexually assaulted, sodomized, and allegedly by an official there with a woman standing guard to allow for this sexual assault to occur. This was not
the details will get pretty graphic here. So we should mention at the top, if you want to avoid any of that, now may be the time to turn away.
Yes, we'll give the disclaimer here. So that was not part of the suit that they filed. So this was only made public after the fact in 2019. And WWE did come out with a statement denying any knowledge of this, of these allegations by Ashley Massaro. Since that time, we have had both a close friend of Ashley Massaro's come out stating she was told contemporaneously at the time of this incident in 2006. And
like Kara Pipia, who did an interview with News Nation recently.
And then John Laurinaitis, through his lawyer, Edward Brennan, stated that Laurinaitis was aware of the allegations, but denying a cover up. And that was per the reporting of Tim Marchman, who also revealed and learned through the NCIS that there was an investigation after Massaro's death, that they looked into the investigation. And that's what brings us here to give hopefully some additional insight into what happened and if there were any additional witnesses or people that had heard of this. So this investigation was initiated in June of 2019 following information from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations about a possible sexual assault that allegedly occurred in 2006 at a naval clinic aboard Camp Life Support Area in Kuwait. And records of the investigative effort showed that Massaro was treated there July 2nd of 2006 for dehydration by an unnamed individual, a former USN lieutenant physician assistant who was interviewed.
Yes, which you could say is perhaps the most interesting part of these investigation records is this pretty lengthy interview that they did with this physician assistant.
Definitely the most. Yeah, information is the one that comes out of that particular interview. They had received medical treatment records indicating that Massaro was seen on July 2nd and prescribed medication for abdominal pain. And then AFOSI and U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division conducted an inquiry into the allegations, providing the results to NCIS. The attending physician, the physician's assistant was interviewed, and they came to an unsuccessful attempt to locate the alleged crime scene being conducted, stating all logical investigative leads have been exhausted, and to date, no subject, scene, or witnesses have been identified. The reported victim is deceased, and no prosecutorial venue exists within the NCISRU Corpus Christi, Texas area of responsibility. Thus, the case is closed as of January 27th, 2020. That's kind of the overview of what this investigation brought out in, well, 4 years ago.
And as far as them not being able to find a crime scene, there's, I believe, some discussion in here as we get into the details about where Ashley Massaro was treated. May have been a tent, may have been sort of an improvised medical clinic that literally may have been disassembled since July of 2006 when this incident is alleged to have occurred.
Interviews included an unnamed official at the Federal Health Care Center in Naval Station Great Lakes, who said she had no knowledge of the naval clinic aboard Camp Life Support in Kuwait. She had been stationed there from February to August of 2006, said she did not know about the events that took place there. August 26th of 2019, they interviewed a representative from K&L Gates. Brandon, can you inform everybody who are K&L Gates and their history and ties with WWE?
Well, I don't want to source guess, but we do know that one Jerry McDivitt has been a longtime lawyer for K&L Gates, and people often get it confused that Jerry McDivitt was never an employee of WWE. He was always an outside attorney, which is fairly unusual, but Jerry McDivitt started working with WWE in representation in, I believe, 1987. So when W was a much smaller company, but he does work for K&L Gates. Well, yes, he did. He's retired now, I think.
If you're looking for what brought Jerry McDivitt into the world of Vince McMahon, the answer to that trivia question is one Jim the Anvil Neidhart, who Jerry McDivitt represented on behalf of the company. And thus a marriage was born that yielded plenty of favorable results for
an
both sides.
An unbreakable bond.
And as we know now, Jerry McDivitt, scheduled to retire, has not officially retired yet, I think.
He told me he was going to retire. I would have to look at the article, look at the timing of when that was, but he was planning on retiring, and that's why we first became aware that maybe something was up, because the MLW lawsuit had different representation associated with it, and it seemed like Jerry McDivitt was out of it. So I asked him, and he said he's retiring soon. This was back in July of 2023 that he said he was planning to retire, and I think he was saying he was going to retire at the end of of last year. So, I mean, we haven't seen anything or heard any comments from him since then to know that he's actually in retirement, but he was planning on it last year.
Huge Sting fan. Just figured, you know what? Time to call it a day after a lengthy career in this particular field that I've been representing. So in the interview with the unnamed representative from K&L Gates, they were unable to provide any additional documents relevant to the investigation. They cited a blog post, which we know to be a series of blog posts that Jimmy Hart provided that were on WWE.com. I believe part one of the blog posts are still there, as you can see here. The subsequent ones I was looking at today look to be dead links now, but they have been archived, and thus when this story first came out, I immediately saved these because I thought they were going to be gone within hours, and they did stay up for a while. It seems that some of them are still up, and you can see Jimmy Hart. What's important about these blogs is that he at least corroborates the fact that Ashley Massaro was treated. They were concerned about her being dehydrated, and like it was never a question that she was treated. We had this account through Jimmy Hart, and the question is what exactly happened while she was being treated. That is at the source of this investigation.
And these came out in 2006 when this trip happened.
In real time, yes.
Yeah.
And okay. So in the interview with the K&L Gates representative, stated that Ashley Massaro insisted on taking part in a photo shoot with troops after the alleged assault would have taken place and would be inconsistent with the affidavit that had stated she was taken back to her hotel room until the end of the tour, with K&L Gates enclosing 10 photos from this shoot that would have been dated July the 3rd of 2006. So, I mean, that is a point that they are putting in there that I don't think would necessarily contradict that an assault took place, but that they would be disputing that Ashley Massaro was taken to her hotel room, and that is where she remained until the end of the tour, at least at the Kuwait portion of the tour.
Right. What they're saying is something that doesn't line up with her account of these line of events in her affidavit.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's about the information that came out of that particular interview and was more than several others here. There was a USN member that was interviewed who was deployed in Kuwait, not familiar with Camp Life Support, not familiar with Massaro or any USO events, besides a country band appearance, no knowledge of Ashley Massaro's allegations. I mean, I'm not an expert in NCIS investigations. I do wonder like how they, I mean, I guess you're just finding representatives that at least were like, these are some people that forget Ashley Massaro that they weren't familiar with. They weren't familiar with this tour and not even familiar with this Camp Life Support that it was stationed in. I don't know even like how you arrive at some of these people that were being interviewed that had zero knowledge of any of this or recollections.
I can only guess that they have a lot. Obviously they have a lot of military records and they were able to locate who is maybe there at that time to see if they knew anything about it. It is interesting that we don't see, I mean, there's a ton of redactions in this, so that it's so much to me that it was kind of hard to follow everything that was going on because there are so many redactions, but it is interesting. It doesn't appear that they made an effort to interview Jimmy Hart or to interview the PR person, first name Gary. Gary Davis, who's on this tour. And Maria Kanellis was on the tour as well, correct?
Correct.
So it seems like there were additional civilian people that they could have interviewed here.
And then there was we go to August the 27th. There was another member of the USN Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton. No recollection of civilians affiliated with WWE, according to their recollections. September 3rd of 2019, a member of USN Patient Administration, a department head. This is a very long title here, who was deployed in Kuwait from February to August of 2006. Again, not familiar with Camp Life Support area, name or facility, could recall a WWE Armed Forces tour, but stated there were so many that came through the area and she did not go to any of them. Stated that didn't believe she was at the same facility. Those were, I would say, the K&L Gates representative would have been the one where you got any kind of recollections or knowledge of this tour. And that takes us to the physician's assistant, for all intents and purposes, was the most important one that we have to discuss here, because not only did this person recall treating Ashley Massaro, was able to draw up a diagram of how this examination building area was designed, seemed to have a very clear memory of things when we are talking that this interview took place in 2019 and we are 13 years removed.
Yeah, exactly. And just a quick note, I think where you're seeing USN is just referring to the US Navy as an abbreviation. Everything has to be an abbreviation in the military.
There were a lot of abbreviations in here. So for this one, we'll kind of skim through the key stuff here of this interview taking place. So this unnamed physician's assistant stated that he was assigned to a tent city 1 mile away from Camp Ali al-Salem in Kuwait as a physician's assistant and was deployed for approximately 6 months in 2006. This person stated that the facility was essentially a double wide trailer that had two urgent care bays, two examination rooms. Also stated that the went through kind of the dress code, which is important because Ashley Massaro did recall what the person in question was wearing. Also added the detail that they were singing happy birthday to this person who allegedly assaulted her as well. And those are kind of the details that we are left with. And kind of he described sort of what the kind of uniform wear was for the people that were working here on this area.
And then there are similarities between what he describes as being, there's an orange shirt that people are, according to this PA, there's an orange shirt that people are wearing as sort of a, I don't know what the word would be. It's not the typical uniform item that you would wear underneath the camouflage, but it was something that as some sort of event or something that people had. And that does line up with what she talks about in the affidavit about somebody wearing an orange shirt. He doesn't say that anybody's wearing an orange shirt, but he does describe that. Yeah, there's may have been reason for somebody to be wearing an orange shirt at that time.
The assistant goes on to state that he recalled seeing Massaro because it was very unusual to see any civilians in the medical facility. They recalled only seeing blank and recalled the day that Massaro was treated was a Sunday and he was off duty, but was called in when he was alerted that there was an issue with a civilian. Redacted stated that the facility was not heavily trafficked on the weekends, but he believes that there would have been 2 to 4 Army medics on duty and a few Navy corpsmen who would be present. Stated that on an average Sunday, there would be between 5 to 10 people on duty. They stated that occasionally when it was slow, some people would come visit their friends who were on duty in the facility and did not recall seeing any old quilts or blankets in the facility, but stated that sometimes the facility personnel or their friends would bring in their personal items during downtimes. Now, why he brings up quilts and blankets is because in the affidavit, it stated that Massaro's affidavit, that when there was a knocking on the door that we believe to be Gary Davis checking on Massaro during this examination, that entered the room and covered her in a quilt or blanket to bring her back to the hotel room. So that is why he is being asked specifically about those items, which again, he is stating he did not recall any quilts or blankets in the facility.
And then I'll just read a couple sentences here from the affidavit, which is from Ashley Massaro saying, finally, Gary, returned and was banging on the door. The man and woman yelled 1 minute and threw a dirty quilt on me as I was lying naked on the table. And when Gary entered the room, he attempted to ask them what was going on, but they immediately stormed out. At the time, my body was still limp and my speech impaired. So Gary wrapped me in a quilt and carried me to the Humvee outside and took me back to the hotel room and then put me in bed as I needed to sleep. So that this is just to remind everybody, this is in the context of Ashley Massaro's claim that she was given a drug that paralyzed her and prevented her from moving, at least from the waist down, while she was assaulted.
The physician's assistant goes on to state that he was not sure how long Massaro was there before he arrived at the facility. They recalled that he first saw Massaro, she was in her street clothes in the exam room. The physician's assistant did not recall meeting Massaro in the urgent care bay or in the waiting area, and that could not recall specifically what Massaro was wearing, but may have been wearing a muscle shirt. The assistant recalled Massaro's hair was done up like she was just finished performing and she had a flower in her hair and may have done some coloring in her hair. Also stated that he recalled Massaro complained of abdominal and pelvic pain. Next up, goes on, recalls that Massaro was accompanied by a male civilian that he did not recognize, but he recalled someone in the clinic saying it was redacted and that the person seemed to be acting skittish and strange. A lot of redactions here, so I'm trying as best to navigate this. They described that blank as a something male in his 30s and perhaps had a mustache and was well-built. So that description does not that does not coincide with anybody that we would know on the WWE side that was on this tour. So this is an unknown individual that, I mean, we can't really assign. I don't think Jimmy Hart is being mistaken as being 30s with and being well built.
I remember discussing this with Bix at the time when they came out. There's a photographer on this tour who's probably too old to be described as somebody in their 30s in 2006. The PR gentleman's name again is Gary
Davis.
Gary Davis is probably too old to be described as a male in his 30s. Jimmy Hart, that doesn't fit Jimmy Hart either, or Maria Kanellis for that matter.
And Ron Simmons, I mean.
And Ron Simmons.
I don't think he's being mistaken in his 30s either in 2006, would be my guess. So goes on to state that when he first saw Massaro, he believed she was drowsy, but she was not falling asleep during conversation or slurring her words. Blank recalled someone else working in the facility may have said that she was high, but Blank was uncertain and stated that he had little experience with people on drugs or alcohol, so he was not sure. So this is important that you are looking at someone who might be in a compromised state to the point that someone else may have even remarked on her potentially being high or under some kind of substance that is unknown, that she was not in a perfectly clear state.
She claims she was drugged, and from the perspective of this PA, she was already maybe under the influence, but he wasn't sure.
The assistant stated he did not see Massaro with an IV at any time when she was in the facility, stated it was customary for the physicians to see the patient before an IV was administered. They stated it was possible that one of the medics or corpsmen gave her an IV at some point, as that was common in Kuwait due to the heat, but he did not witness it. They stated that a Navy corpsman checked Massaro's basic vital signs and medical data before he came into the exam room, and that was routine. They stated that he entered the exam room, Massaro was there and alone, and conducted a preliminary meeting with Massaro in the exam room and asked her questions regarding her medical issues. They could not recall if the female representative was in the room with her at that time. They stated it would be atypical for a corpsman to be in the room for the medical question portion of the exam. They stated that Massaro was talking, moving, and seemed lucid at the time and was dressed in her street clothes. They stated after he finished speaking to her, he exited the room and returned sometime later, and he conducted an exam to include a pelvic exam, which Massaro agreed to.
And the importance of there, he's corroborating that there was a female corpsman in the room, which aligns with what's stated in Ashley Massaro's affidavit, where she says, I'll put it on the screen here, that I was somehow given to this man as some type of sick birthday present, and it also made me sick that the female soldier willingly guarded the door, that there's a female military person guarding the door.
And I guess we can talk a bit about the aspect of the pelvic exam, which David Bixenspan also did his own report on this. If you we'll put the link in the description, but focused on this quite a bit. And this is a aspect to the story that we have to look at, in that there was at least the acknowledgement that Ashley Massaro could have been under the influence of something that somebody noted, and the ethics of administering a pelvic exam, which is something that has been, greatly focused upon in the last number of years, to the point now that there are 25 states in the U.S. that do not allow for pelvic exams to be conducted when someone is under anesthesia. And this was something that some students would be essentially privy to when they were administering examinations on patients who were under anesthesia.
Right. And I think neither of us are experienced to describe what exactly a pelvic exam was. I mean, I did not really understand what one was until reading up for this story, but I do believe we have a clip that will do a better job than we could of explaining this.
This is a recent news story that NBC News conducted about 4 months ago, and we've condensed it down, and we thought it would be best to rely on this for context.
Reports some doctors are sounding the alarm about this controversial practice.
Surgery can be daunting. Patients put their lives in doctors' hands. does a patient have the right to know what happens to them when they are under anesthesia?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But according to doctors and medical students NBC News spoke with, sometimes surgery patients are given one of the most intimate procedures without their explicit consent, a pelvic exam.
On the surface of it, it seems like a violation of medical ethics, is it?
I would say it's a violation of bodily autonomy, certainly.
It may sound surprising, but Dr. Julie Kaur, an OBGYN, says the practice has been around for a while. Although exact numbers are hard to pin down because patients are often unaware, a recent study estimates that more than 3.5 million men and women may have received an unconsented intimate exam within the past 5 years. Dr. Kaur says the exams can be a key part of residents' training and may be performed during gynecological surgeries because it is easier, even if the patient doesn't actually need the procedure.
The muscles of the abdomen are more relaxed, so you can actually appreciate the anatomy in a kind of an easier way.
But consent should be mandatory, she says.
And I was asked to do a pelvic exam on a patient that I know I hadn't consented specifically.
Did you want to do it?
You know, no, I did not.
Dr. Rohini Kashalyasiva is the head of the American Medical Student Association.
I actually ended up saying no, that I wasn't going to perform this pelvic exam.
She is among a number of medical students who are speaking out.
It's just morally wrong. If you were in that position, would you want that happening to you?
Attention to the issue has led to 25 states enacting laws requiring explicit consent for pelvic exams on a patient under anesthesia. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists states that if the exam offers a patient no personal benefit and is performed solely for teaching purposes, it should be performed only with her specific informed consent. Some doctors have resisted the need for specific consent, arguing it's not necessary if general consent is given before going into the operating room, and the pelvis doesn't need to be treated differently than any other part of the body. But Dr. Kaur disagrees.
It's because if you ask a patient how they feel and whether they would want to know if a student was doing an exam, patients overwhelmingly say, yes, this is different.
And she says doctors should listen.
Because patients think it's different, I think it's imperative that we treat it differently.
Stephanie Gosk, NBC News, Chicago.
Thanks for watching.
All right. That was the NBC News clip. That was from a couple of months ago, kind of going over this aspect. So I think that just adds a bit more context to this as well that we are discussing here. And Brandon and I, not experts on that particular field.
No, but it's if you just look at it on its face, I think a lot of men in particular who don't go through this thing would think it's just, I don't know, it's some sort of brief, you know, outer medical exam. And it's not, it's much more intense and internal than that.
Yeah. And just doing some basic research today, I mean, this does extend to male patients as well when it comes to prostate exams as well. But this is, you know, something that has certainly come under a lot of scrutiny and fire over the last decade or so that we're talking about here. So getting back to the interview with the physician's assistant, we get up to the point here where the female corpsman is in the room and blank banged on the door and was calling Massaro's name and asking her if everything was okay. Blank stated that he had to stop the exam briefly so that Massaro could respond. Blank stated that Massaro responded and said that everything was fine and she was having an exam done. Blank stated that Massaro seemed nonchalant when she said everything was fine and the manager stopped banging on the door and did not knock again. So this would at least be in line with Ashley Massaro's affidavit that there was a knock on the door, but the degree to how she responded and what was done, that is at odds.
Yeah.
Which Brandon recited the passage in the affidavit of Ashley's account at the time in 2000 and well, when this affidavit was delivered.
Right. So not in dispute that there's knocking on the door and then Gary Davis was trying to check on her, but there's certainly disagreement about, you know, why that banging on the door was happening and what exactly was happening in the exam room.
The rest here, there's a bit of discussion on who this female corpsman was. And then it states, it does not recall anyone saying it was their birthday, the day that Massaro was treated, or having a birthday at the time of the exam. Of course, this loops back to Ashley Massaro recalling that they were singing happy birthday to this person that she was accusing of. and did not recall giving Massaro any drugs or medications. And it concluded with that this physician's assistant did not see Massaro leave the facility, but Massaro could have been resting in one of the urgent care bays and did not witness it. Stated he did not see Massaro crying or upset during the exam, incapacitated, or anything that would have made him think that she had been sexually assaulted. Stated that he did not observe any disturbances at the facility other than the manager banging on the door. So, I mean, that is kind of the most detail that we've got of any of the people that are interviewed. This included the diagram of the makeup here. Also worth noting is that there was one individual that kind of oversaw everything that that would not take part in an interview, that there was outreach to this individual who at first stated they basically acquiesced that you could send a questionnaire of various questions. But once those questions were sent, it was still turned down and did not participate in the investigation.
Right. I'm trying to find that portion of the PDF here. But I almost thought at first that this was because there's so many redactions, it's hard to tell who's who. I almost thought that was, you know, some of an executive from WWE who was referring this investigation to lawyers. But yet there does seem to be somebody who's not interested in talking to the investigators and are deferring them to their lawyer.
I'm just pulling this up here. It was, interview. This was just a redacted individual, a civilian, I assume.
Yeah.
Pursuant to the captioned investigation on July 17th, 2019, RA contacted case agent to provide an update on the case and discuss a questionnaire. Case agent provided the reporting agent with questions on July the 18th of 2019. The next day, the questionnaire was sent via email. On July 24th, redacted emailed RA stating that blank would not provide any further information to the case and all future communication should be sent directly to redacted. That was the outline here.
Right.
So, I mean, at the end of this, the case was closed, and just stating that there was not enough evidence to be discovered. The case was closed, and I don't know what more you will necessarily get out of this beyond if there are any other people. Like, certainly there is, the most insight you have is through the physician's assistant outlining something that would be a vastly different experience than the one that Ashley Massaro alleged in her affidavit. And that is what kind of the conclusion is. And that's going to be inconclusive for some.
Yes. We're being fact checked in real time by David Bixenspan that it looks like it was the officer in charge who is the person who refused to answer the questions. And we do see that the reference here to the officer in charge, the OIC of the clinic where Ashley Massaro was treated. And I do believe it's that is the person who was a military person at the time. And by the time this investigation is happening, may be a civilian.
Okay. So there is clarity on the matter. The officer in charge who did not take part in the questionnaire. Any final thoughts, Brandon, on where you are here? If you expect any follow-up beyond this, I think that now it is still the question of kind of how this was handled on the WWE side coming out of it. I mean, there was a very, very black and white denial of any knowledge of this that was issued in May of 2019. And that has definitely been, you know, contradicted by several sources at that point. And what kind of action or not that WWE took in regards to what Ashley had gone through.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's much dispute. You have Dr. Rios, who's the W doctor at the time, saying that he was told by Ashley Massaro that she says she was assaulted. You have John Laurinaitis saying, yes, I became aware of it at the time, and other W executives became aware of it at the time. And you have Ashley Massaro's affidavit saying that she experienced something very traumatic. And you have WWE's account that they know no such thing, according to their statement from 2019. So that's at least three parties here against one. And we do have at least this interview describing at least treatment here that she went through in Kuwait.
All right. We will continue to follow. I mean, if there is anything more beyond this. I mean, it's not going to bring any kind of solid conclusion to the story that I think people were. I mean, I think anyone that knew that this investigation closed so many years ago, I think it was just curious to see who was going to be interviewed and if you were going to get any more details beyond what was known on through the affidavit and trying to find more details. But I mean, it was, you know, a investigation where they did speak to many people. It just did not provide a whole lot of details outside of the physician's assistant.
And that this investigation took place so long after the allegations are alleged to have taken place from 2006 to 2019, which makes the investigation and accountability so much harder to achieve, because you've got a great deal of time that's passed and a lot of people who are in service are no longer in service. And according to Massaro's account, she was told not to say anything publicly, not to pursue, you know, any sort of investigation or justice because of this. According to her account, she was told by Vince McMahon and others to just be quiet about this because that would ruin the relationship between the military and WWE.
Yeah. We do know from Ashley Massaro's side of things was that she had at least trusted those that were on the tour and alerted them, but also with the caveat, she did not want this to be shared. If she had, it's all theoretical of her. Obviously, WWE found out, and Massaro doesn't know how certain people at the company found out. But once we were at that point, and Massaro's side was that she had this meeting, including Vince McMahon. And at that point, the prudent thing would have been, with the blessing of Ashley Massaro, that an investigation could have taken place at that time in 2006, not 13 years later when the victim is deceased.
Yeah, and some of this information comes from the Audible podcast that was, its entire subject was Ashley Massaro. And there's interviews there from Dr. Rios, who confirms that this happened in real time, that she was told by Ashley Massaro that she was assaulted, as well as an interview with Paul London, who was her boyfriend at the time, who was also aware of these claims from Massaro.
We will transfer over to Vince McMahon. And this week, there was a SEC filing from TKO that there was going to be the intent to sell Vince McMahon more of his Class A common shares worth just under $412 million and looking to get rid of over 5.3 million shares. So what is the impact on Vince McMahon's overall stake in the company once the sale is complete?
He goes from about 12% of the entire company to about 9% of the entire company. So he still has quite a bit of stock. I don't know if he's still the biggest individual shareholder. We could look into that. But he does have a lot of stock still. He's parting with over 5 million shares. And this comes after he made a bigger sale in November, where he liquidated over $600 million worth of TKO stock. He is now here. I believe he's in the process of finalizing these sales throughout this week. He is selling over $400 million worth of TKO stock. $400 million versus $600 million, according to my sources, is over $1 billion in stock that he's liquidating into cash. Plus, you can go back to September 12th, and TKO paid out a one-time dividend to all shareholders. And because Vince owned so much stock at that time, he got a $111 million one-time special dividend for the closing of the merger of WWE and UFC into TKO. So Vince McMahon has liquidated or been paid out and will be paid out when this transaction is completed well over $1 billion. And I think it's important to emphasize, like, we talk about how, you know, there's billionaires over here and over there, and Mark Zuckerberg is a billionaire and Elon Musk's a billionaire. I don't know if they're cash billionaires. I mean, they're billionaires certainly in their market value of the securities, the stock that they hold. But I don't know that there's that many people who can say that they have $1 billion in cash in their accounts. Who knows? He may have already put these into non-liquid assets at this point. But that's a lot of cash in a short amount of time to have transferred to you.
So with this stock sale, I mean, it is gasoline on the speculation of just a flame of speculation of why is he doing this. Let's first rewind to last week, and we're going to replay this from the TKO earnings call last week when the large shareholder himself, Vince McMahon, was asked about in coded terms.
If a very large shareholder were to sell a lot of stock at once, would you be open to buying that stock directly?
On the second question, look, you know, I think we would, you know, generally be opportunistic or look to be opportunistic, and we would view any opportunity through the lens of creating shareholder value. There was a shareholder that sold stock. As you know, we participated, as I mentioned in our prepared remarks, to the tune of $100 million, roughly 1.3 million shares.
And Brandon, just, I mean, let's call it out. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Vince McMahon specifically in terms of cashing stock. Yep. He still holds, I believe, 20 million shares. Exactly. It's all registered. And he'll do whatever he's going to do. And you know, we're on the sideline. We'll have a look. We'll see. We have no idea on timing. We're not having any discussion with him. He's given us no point of view on his motive or if he plans to sell or not sell or if he does, how much. So, you know, we're going to wait around and find out just like you.
Turns out that was pretty damn accurate because this was 6 days before this SEC filing comes in that Vince McMahon is unloading this latest amount of stock. Again, over 5.3 million shares worth about $412 million. And just so happens that today, Mark Shapiro was taking part in a media and telecom conference that Brandon Thurston was first in line to make sure he was on the line to catch any comments from Mark Shapiro. Was this a newsworthy event, and was the large shareholder mentioned?
He was. It's Morgan Stanley TMT week, and this is not the only day of the Morgan Stanley TMT conference. He buries the JV, the joint venture, the bundle that WBD, Disney, and Fox are coming together to do, saying it's a big nothing. That's the big takeaway in the sports media world. But to the wrestling fan, the clip that we'll play now would be the most interesting one.
Are you able to comment as to whether TKO participated in the Vince McMahon recently announced share sale?
Yes, we did not participate in the recent sale on Vince McMahon's load that he dropped off. And this is now his second time. He's gone from 28 million shares to 15 million shares. He now roughly has 8.5%. We're not in conversations with Vince. I said this on the call. We don't talk to him. We don't have conversations. We don't know his motives, his plans, his timelines. What, if any? He doesn't consult with us. He doesn't work for the company. He doesn't work at the company. He doesn't come into the offices of the company, and he's not coming back to the company. And that's where we sit.
That's pretty clear.
He doesn't work for TKO on weekends, on weekdays, on holidays, on any day. Mark Shapiro wants you to know that Vince McMahon is gone and he's never coming back. That's what he says.
We have shut down that gym, okay? There is no access at all, Vince McMahon. I mean, they are making it beyond clear that they want to sever any and all ties to Vince McMahon. He is radioactive to this company that they do not want to have. Like, obviously, they see him as like absolutely nothing to want to attach themselves in even the loosest of senses to.
Yeah. And just to clarify, if you're interested, what they're talking about when he says that we didn't participate in this transaction. If you go back to the November transaction, there was this press release that was put out that said things like Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro, they participated in this stock transaction and they bought, 12,500 shares. And then TKO itself, it was TKO itself that participated. In any case, in this transaction, which was a bit larger in November, the executives themselves, and I think the company did participate in buying some of the shares that Vince was getting rid of. But really, it's Morgan Stanley, in fact, that is the underwriter of these transactions. So it's Morgan Stanley, the big bank, that's going to take most of these shares from Vince. And apparently all of these shares in this most recent transaction from this month. And Morgan Stanley has been the one that that underwrote his margin loan that he took out after the second XFL went bankrupt too. I think he needed some financing at that time. So Morgan Stanley is his go-to apparently.
And back in November, when he sold that first wave of stock, it did result in around a 6% drop in the TKO stock. What was the impact, if any, on the stock this time around following that news that came down on Monday night?
It has not been a big deal, right? We're looking at this today, and it's down not quite 2%, and the indexes are up slightly. So it is suffering a bit, but this isn't huge, right? If we look at the five-day timeline, what day did this come? I guess it is down from the, if we look at this on the 4th.
It was Monday after hours that the filing was made, as I recall.
Right, and that was the 4th. So we look at this on the, if I can find like where this closed at on the 4th, it closes at around $82, and it's now trading at $79. So it is down somewhat. I don't think this is the impact that the November sale had, though.
No, that was a more dramatic increase, to the point that Ari Emanuel did have to address the sale of stock and the impact that it did have, at least in the immediate aftermath of.
For people watching the video, I believe the coinciding time of Vince's transaction, it's where the stock goes from $84.90 to immediately $79.26. So it falls by what is that? Almost $5 in value. Whereas this time, it's not quite as severe.
Do you have any, without just like pure guesswork of like what is incentivizing Vince McMahon to sell now? And I mean, could it simply be that he is looking at slowly divesting himself, or do you feel that he will always maintain at least a healthy portion of company stock? And what power does that give Vince McMahon in terms of being someone that is off the board, no longer holds a title, but still does have 9% of shares?
Gives him 9% of the vote.
And
he could, I suppose he could get other investors to get on board with his intentions if he wanted to, if they were willing. What could he really accomplish, though? I don't know. He doesn't have the voting power, the enhanced voting power that he had when he made his comeback in early 2023, though. So it's a very different story.
He would need allies to be any kind of, you know, just activist investor, which I feel is probably further from his immediate future of what he is going to be looking at. But I mean, he is, as you mentioned, he has liquefied so much amount that even if he were looking at the prospect of a federal investigation of the Janelle Grant case, making it to trial, this is still an incredible amount of money that he has come into now that he has instant access to.
I'm sure his legal expenses will be pretty high around this time, before this time, after this time, for a while to come. But $1 billion is probably way more than he needs. But who knows what he's up to?
I mean, that might pull Jerry out of retirement if that's the going rate. So anything else that came out of the conference today with Mark Shapiro, or was that the major headline?
We did get wrestling aggregation's favorite type of news, almost news, that NXT almost, well, there were discussions about NXT going to Netflix. And this was, I should set this up as, this was in response to a question about whether or not Netflix could be the home of the PLEs and the library. And Mark Shapiro got on to talking about how, well, let's take one thing at a time. And he got into some discussion about how the Raw deal came together. So we'll listen to that.
You know, we had a lot of pressure when we announced the SmackDown deal. And you and I had conversations about that. The market was freaking out. You know, Raw, NXT, why didn't they announce it? They don't have anybody. There's no demand. They're not going to get the 1-4 increase. There was, and I'm not saying that to be a, hey, we did it, you know, look at us now. There was pressure,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But we said from the beginning, we're going to be patient and it's going to work in our favor. And it over-delivered on our expectations. Never did I think Netflix was coming in, just to be clear. Not in my wildest dreams did I think Netflix was coming in. And when we first started talking to Netflix, it was frankly about NXT. It wasn't even about Raw. And then that just turned into a bigger conversation. And then the Raw conversation became a global conversation.
This is the most excitable man in this TKO. Like, with respect to Dana White or, you know, Nick Khan on a good day, there's no one that just gets his juices flowing more about this business than Mark Shapiro.
You're a big
even Raw. It was going to be NXT.
You're a big Mark Shapiro fan.
I would I find him to be an interesting individual. I think he was absolutely wanting to do a victory lap on all you naysayers out there. I think he definitely likes to create a lot of noise out of nothing, but nonetheless.
One other thing that's newsworthy is he hinted at lots of WME clients, maybe, who are celebrities appearing at WrestleMania.
I cannot wait. I hope all of PBR is represented in like the fourth row. Michael Chandler screaming on commentary.
Stephen A. Smith.
Without a headset.
He disclosed in this conversation that Stephen A. Smith is their client, which I'm sure is not a secret. But that is one person that who he mentioned who is a client and who sure can cut a promo.
That's right. All right. So that was the Mark Shapiro front that I'm sure there will be more interesting chatter in the lead up to both WrestleMania and UFC 300 in the coming months. Something I just wanted to note as well, kind of a sidebar story to everything, is that the UFC antitrust trial is still set to be going down in the middle of April, right after UFC 300. It's supposed to start April the 15th. And I would say that the leading outlet when it comes to this coverage, going back almost 10 years since this antitrust suit was filed, was BloodyElbow.com. And they have gone through many financial hits and changes and going independent. And this past week, the site was sold by Nate Wilcox. And it looks as though tons of the stories have disappeared. And that has been... kind of its own focus. But this has been the site that has been the go-to place when it comes to the business of mixed martial arts and covering a lot of stories, not just simply, stories on like the bare facts, but the follow-ups, going deep, obtaining documents and explaining them from the work of Anton Tabuena and John Nash and Stephanie Hayes, like a lot of great individuals. And I just hope that there is a place within MMA to be covering this in a way that is sustainable for the people that are writing about this, that this is very important information. And it's not as though there's a great depth of it in the mixed martial arts space that is going heavy. And this is a very important period as we get closer to this trial to have that kind of coverage and focus upon.
So they've sold the website. Do we know to who?
It is an outlet called, I will get the exact name, but
the implication is that the new owner doesn't want to investigate the antitrust story as much because the stories on the Bloody Elbow website have been removed.
It is to an outlet called GRV Media. And I guess that there have been inquiries into where these stories have gone. And I guess there has been a dispute if this was stories that had been taken down prior to the sale, as opposed to the new ownership just wiping them off. But it is, I think certainly the immediate focus is none of the staff that made Bloody Elbow are coming over with this transaction. So you are losing all of this institutional knowledge of the MMA business that made this site like the core. Like, with all due respect, if you sold WrestleNomics tomorrow to Joe Blow, it's not WrestleNomics without Brandon Thurston. And suddenly we're doing stories on top 10 entrances at WrestleMania's history.
It would make a great listicle site, wouldn't it? I think that would be more profitable.
I think that's what all of your patrons would be craving more of, lists.
Yes. Yes, it's numbers. Lists have numbers.
So, I mean, it's... yeah, it is certainly, I think, a very important time to be looking at all of these MMA stories as well, because there is so much crossover that you can learn from in terms of how, I mean, these are essentially the same businesses now under one ownership group in TKO. And I think Bloody Elbow was a major contributor in that side, and not always the most popular side among people, but they did very, very essential work that was not always the sexiest stuff or the kind of work that is going to gain you tons of revenue either, but it's very important. And it's this continued crossroads of kind of, if you're running a website, what is the content to be focusing upon, and kind of what is your duty as a news outlet to your audience? Is it simply going for the thing that will get the most attention, or is it things that are of vital interest and holding these major companies to scrutiny and being transparent in a industry that is anything but.
I mean, that's I think it's one of the problems of our time is that revenue is attractive and it's a must for sustaining people's jobs and livelihoods. But that leads to a lot of problematic outcomes when you've got, you know, sensational coverage and coverage that doesn't necessarily inform people, but sure stirs them up and gets a reaction and gets people to share this article or to quote tweet it in an angry or hysterical way. And that goes for wrestling too, obviously.
Let's finish off with a couple of ratings notes if there are not any other items you want to get to, Brandon. But if we look back to SmackDown on Friday night, we won't go through all these numbers because there were about a million different shows since Friday. But SmackDown did 2,348,000 viewers and a 0.64. Starring the Bloodline for about 40 minutes of the opening of this show on Fox. Only a minor increase to the overall number, but I mean, there was like some sizable growth over these 40 minutes, especially when The Rock came out at about, I would say, roughly the 15-minute mark of SmackDown.
Sure, let's look at the quarter hours. 2.75 million viewers for that was the third quarter hour that contained this long segment. So it did grow throughout. It's not like, I mean, if you wanted to say this is going to bore people entire amount and make them tune out, that's certainly not what happened here in the live and same day quarter hours. This three quarter hour live in ring segment grew and grew the audience and grew it to a pretty high peak. Now, of course, it declined afterwards and it did more of a normal, the rest of the show did more of a normal level of viewership for SmackDown, but it did a higher number overall, of course, because of these three quarter hours that contained The Rock and Roman Reigns and friends.
Yeah, not enough to lift the overall number, but in Canada, highest audience in Canada since March 31st, nearly a year. So, I mean, up here in Canada, they were optimistic. Rock's coming back at some point on these 2 hours. So they just stuck around for the whole thing. Collision on Saturday. This was a taped show from Huntsville, Alabama, airing the night before Revolution, doing 455,000 viewers and a 0.13 in the 18 to 49 demo. So a taped show, not only up from the prior week, which was the live show the same day as Elimination Chamber. This was their second largest number of the year. And again, being a tape show certainly did not impact this number, but it does tell you the difference of not being on a WWE PLE weekend. But there you have it. Will we see more collisions being taped? Because they're taping Collision again this week. They're doing tonight and tomorrow in Duluth, Georgia. And I guess that will be something interesting to see in the future if there's a cost savings of doing the Wednesday, Thursday combo instead of doing a separate night on a Saturday. Just having some regularity of doing that, even though I think it's a tough ask to go to a market twice on back-to-back nights.
Yeah. We saw quite a bit of that, right? In the Southern Ontario loop that they did about a year ago or so, where you went to Hamilton and Toronto in nearby dates. If you're doing it in the same venue, you'll save money. But if you're doing consecutive days in different locations is another story, and it still adds a lot of expense. But the more you can tape in one sitting, sure, the more you'll gain. And the live element, there aren't really clear stories about a live show versus a tape show in wrestling having a huge effect. I mean, obviously, going back to the days in like the late 90s and early 2000s when Raw was taped, there was no effect then. Now it's a different time now where you've got people with the internet in their phones. But we still, on the occasions where SmackDown, for that matter, Dynamite have been taped, it hasn't had a discernible effect, in my view, to show that live is that much better than taped. To some extent, you want to do it live, right? And most of these shows are live, and that's live is a very valuable word in the media rights environment. But there isn't overwhelming evidence here yet that live and spoilers really affect what of viewership.
And then Raw on Monday, 1,649,000 viewers and a 0.54 in the demo, down 5% from the week prior, but still first on cable for the night. And outside of curling, it was nothing but Raw on Monday night at the top of the sports charts.
Curling did a big rating.
Actually, I should rephrase that. They were behind Monday Night Hockey, but they beat curling in the demo. You wouldn't believe this, but it is an older audience that watches curling, younger audience for Raw, but not an overall viewership. Curling dominates here in Canada. Curling is another beast, okay, in Canada.
Well, all that yelling, I think, is what really attracts the audiences. To take a quick look at quarter hours here, the peak of the show was the second quarter hour, which had the Cody Rhodes, Seth Rollins live promo in it, which peaked at a 0.60 in the demo and about 1.86 million viewers, and it grew from the prior quarter quite substantially. So special interest, you could say, in that Cody and Seth segment.
Yeah, I mean, for all we discuss about all these talking segments, they are the big winners on all of these shows. So to do a 20-minute talking segment on Monday to build up a talking rebuttal on Friday for SmackDown, I'm sure they will have an equally strong number coming up this Friday with the summit of all your principal WrestleMania characters. And there you go. That is up to date. We do not have an NXT number yet from Roadblock. Going down Tuesday night. Will they hit a roadblock in their trajectory as they lead into their big show? That's the big question. We will find out later today.
Yeah, I haven't seen ratings yet. We do have one super chat from Jake from Windy City. You want to read it?
Yes. Let us look at what Jake has to say. Dana White telling Aaron Bronstetter that the lawsuit, quote, has nothing to do with him and he never thinks about it. Isn't there a chance he might testify? Well, Dana White was deposed in that has come out through discovery of him being, you know, interviewed. I think there's probably a decent chance if this goes to trial that Dana White would have to testify. That to me would be a really reasonable assumption. Does Dana White never think about this lawsuit? I can't get into the man's head. I can't tell you if he has never thought about this lawsuit. Not once. Not until this question was brought up did he realize, you know what? That thing that I was deposed for, yeah, that has entered my mind. I don't know.
There was a little bit of discussion of the antitrust lawsuit on the Morgan Stanley talk today, and Mark Shapiro just said some things to the effect of, you know, are talking about how well paid UFC fighters are if they're winning, and they believe in the merits of their case, and they are in mediation, so who knows what will happen.
Yeah, I did catch that line from Mark Shapiro. It's like, we've got a ton of competitors now. There's tons out there that are trying to get at us now. It's like, I don't know if we'd call it a slew of competitors that are at you. In fact, one of your main competitors just got pretty much bought out by your other competitor. There was such a gap between UFC and everyone else. But anyway, that's the picture that was painted. All right. That brings everyone up to speed on what is going on in the world of professional wrestling and some mixed martial arts as well. There is a free edition of WrestleNomics that you can catch from this past weekend. Actually, from this past Monday night, we had the lead-in for Raw through Brandon Thurston.
Yes, Monday evening. I think I'll be doing that after WrestleMania, too. I'll be recording probably on Monday so that I'm not doing a show right before some big event that has a lot of news and business news coming out of it. So you can check that out this past Monday's episode on all WrestleNomics platforms for free.
All right. You can catch all of that tonight. I'm back with Wei Ting. We are here on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel minutes after Dynamite, where we are going to spend the whole show reviewing the new logo, the new set. It's the season premiere of Dynamite. Are you aware that last week was the season finale?
No.
Tonight.
Why is that the end of the season and this the beginning of a new season?
Because Tony Khan tweeted as such on Tuesday. That is, it's a season premiere Wednesday night. Tune in. New colors, new logos, brand new coat of paint on Dynamite coming up.
I did get logo assets from AEW. I asked for, can you give me the logo, the new logo, with a transparent background in high res, and it was delivered. And I shared it with Waiting.
Do you, any vibes you have regarding the Revolution number that you feel it has? What do you see as the ceiling? Is 200,000 within striking distance for the show? It had a lot of attention going into it. I feel 200's high, but I feel this is going to perform very well for them.
Maybe. Do you think that Bleacher Report issue has any effect on sales?
That's a caveat that you had problems, correct?
Yes, I ordered it and then I could not watch it immediately. But then I was able to watch it about, I don't know, 30 minutes later. So on one hand, I mean, that's a terrible experience to put customers through. You never want to do that, obviously. And that makes a lot of people upset and feel like they should get refunds or partial refunds or whatever. Yet on the other hand, like, did that really affect sales, though? Because unless you were looking at Twitter and seeing other people complain about it, you wouldn't necessarily be deterred from ordering.
I thought everyone seemed to, like, their problems were corrected by the second match on the pay-per-view. I don't know if people, I mean, you still might get people complaining and wanting a refund at the end of it. I don't know if that'll be a real big impact on the number. My guess would be that it would be a really small thing, but there was that, and it was very notable for U.S. viewers.
I would say, and I mildly buy the idea that their late buys are strong when they have a really strongly reviewed show, which this was. So there's a little bit incremental reason to think that this is going to do a high number. That's, you know, 200 would be really high, right? That's the all in number, we believe. And so maybe high hundreds, I would think. Yeah.
If they don't plug the replay tonight with the quotation, epic Pat McAfee, voice of Raw, then they're really missing out on an opportunity here.
Why not? I mean, his comment is on record.
They should absolutely use that quote on Dynamite. I think that would be tremendous. All right, that's going to wrap things up. Go on to patreon.com/WrestleNomics and postwrestlingcafe.com to get your whole fix of the post-wrestling WrestleNomics experience. We will be back next week. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time. Thanks to everybody for tuning in live. We appreciate each and every one of you, even the negative comments that come our way. We are immune to your dislike. But thank you for listening regardless. And that is it for this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston.